What do you think is most important? And we just have a minute. I want to ask both of you this question to happen now, Alex.
Well, I think El Salvador has considered gangs of terrorist organizations in 2015, and it's now violating the civil rights of and due process of all those people. We don't know what Sessions is going to come back with. We know that there's been social cleansing, extrajudicial killings in El Salvador. People are fleeing behind those policies, and basically now we're looking at Sessions coming up with policies that we don't know where they're going to take us. So that's the most dangerous thing to expect.
And Catalina Adorno, we just have 15 seconds, but what you are demanding now?
Yes, I think the threats against our immigrant community are nothing new. They've always been there. I think right now, because of the political atmosphere that we're currently living in, we are going to continue to receive these threats that are going to bring in more violence, more deportations, more family separations. And that's why it's important for all of us to come together, for all of the immigrant community to come together, take action, which is a strategy that has never failed us, and to take high risks, because that's the only way that we can win.
Catalina Adorno and Alex Sanchez, I want to thank you for being with us. That does it for our show. Our website, democracynow.org. Happy birthday, Rob Young. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up now, or coming up next, is your Friday evening news.
Hi, I'm Ed Melnick. In solidarity with San Francisco's 50-year anniversary of the Summer of Love, I'm inviting you to join me for a 2-hour special Monday sampler on August 7th.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline.
From the 1967 music scene, music from artists like Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, the Beatles, and many others will be featured. Join me for 2 hours to tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's Monday, August 7th, 2 to 4 p.m.
If you're going to San Francisco,
hot damn, that pie's good!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pie-a-thon Arts and Music Festival on Saturday, July 29th at Area 51 in Portland.
Agent Cooper here might want to try a slice of that pie.
Pie-a-thon is a celebration of the arts with live music, art performances, and pie.
They got a cherry pie there that'll kill ya.
Featuring Those Willows, Violin Secrets, Belinda Rose Circus Arts, live painting, and much, much more.
No, cherry pie and coffee. In fact, I want 16 cups of coffee.
Again, that's the Pie-a-thon Arts and Music Festival on Saturday, July 29th at Area 51, 3928 Southeast 51st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This must be where pies go when they die.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as KBOO Night every second Thursday. Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton in Portland. Schedule an info at 503-238-5588 or at cstpdx.com. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland NAACP has issued a call to action to prevent amendments to the city's settlement agreement with the Department of Justice.
The Free Lunch for All program has come to an end in 12 Portland public schools.
And a Multnomah County grand jury has cleared a Portland police officer in the shooting of Terrell Johnson.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 28, 2017. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. A Multnomah County grand jury has cleared Officer Samuel Ajir of any criminal wrongdoing in the May shooting death of Terrell Johnson. According to grand jury transcripts that were released yesterday, Ajir stated that he was chasing Johnson on foot when the man suddenly turned around with a box cutter knife. The officer was backpedaling when he tripped over a curb and began to fall backwards. He claimed that he fired a shot, but Johnson kept coming. When the suspect did not stop, he continued firing, and Johnson, age 24, died at the scene. At the time of his death, his family said that he had been struggling with drug addiction that may have led to mental health issues. In addition to Ajir, four other witnesses testified that Johnson had been threatening them near the TriMet Flavel Street transit station. One witness stated that Johnson had chased him with what he believed was a sharp object in his hand prior to the arrival of the police. The Portland Police Bureau will now conduct an internal affairs investigation to confirm that the shooting was within department guidelines.
The Portland NAACP has issued a call to action to prevent amendments to the settlement agreement between the U.S. Department of Justice and the City of Portland. In an email to members, the association expressed concern that the proposed amendments were worked out in private with no community input. They also point out that the DOJ under Attorney General Jeff Sessions has generally opposed police reform agreements and that the city is using that position as a license to modify the agreement into meaninglessness. Of particular concern is the plan to replace the Community Oversight Advisory Board with the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing, or PCCEP. The association warns that the amendments remove the city council from the agreement, leaving the mayor as the only one responsible for staffing the PCCEP and the sole recipient of their reports. They also worry that the changes to the agreement would remove community oversight and eliminate fairness in hearings. The City Council has scheduled a hearing on the amendment for Thursday, August 3rd. Portland's NAACP President Joanne Hardesty is urging community members to attend the council meeting and sign up to testify against the proposed changes. She is also recommending that concerned citizens make your objections known to the mayor and city council members via phone calls and emails.
As the old saying goes, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and that has certainly come true for 12 Portland public schools. Yesterday, notices were sent to the families of the affected schools that the free lunches for all will be discontinued in October. Under the program, all students at a supported school were provided with a free lunch. The lunches were funded by a 2013 federal program that provided money to schools if more than 40% of their students came from homes served by support programs such as food stamps. School officials noted that with the improving economy, fewer families were qualifying for food stamps. Students from low-income families can still apply for free or reduced-cost lunches, but all students at the 12 schools will no longer get free meals automatically. Most of the affected schools are located in North Portland. When the program is discontinued, students will have to pay about $3 for their lunch. The schools will still provide free breakfast to any student that requests it.
In a surprise move, Arizona Senator John McCain cast a deciding no vote early this morning, ending the GOP's latest effort to roll back the Affordable Care Act. McCain joined fellow Republican Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine in voting against the so-called skinny repeal. The three Republicans joined all 48 Democrats, sending the bill to defeat by a vote of 51-49. Excuse me. The votes seem to signal the end of the latest effort Republicans were making to repeal and replace Obamacare, something they've been promising to do for the last 7 years. The bare-bones health care proposal was dubbed the skinny repeal because it left big sections of Obamacare untouched. But the measure failed to bring the extremes of the Republican Party together. Conservatives felt that it left too much of Obamacare intact, while moderates were concerned that even this pared-down bill would still cause 16 million people to lose their health insurance. After the defeat, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that it was time to move on, but despite their apparent victory, Democrats and Obamacare advocates are still not resting easy. Immediately after the vote, the president tweeted that, quote, three Republicans and 48 Democrats let the American people down. As I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode, then deal. Watch, end quote. Trump has made repeal of Obamacare a key element of the pitch to the conservative base, and most Washington insiders believe he has not given up. Supporters point out that despite Trump's claims, Obamacare is not imploding and that failures in the health insurance market have actually been caused by the president's deliberate attempts to destabilize it.
In this episode of Labor History in Two, Rick Smith covers the 1917 parade down New York's Fifth Avenue to protest racism.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day more than 10,000 African Americans marched down New York's Fifth Avenue in what is known as the Silent Parade. The protest came in the aftermath of the July 2nd East St. Louis race riot and a number of lynchings in Texas. Organized by black scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, and the NAACP, the Silent Parade protested lynchings and anti-black violence. Children led the march dressed in white. Women, who were also dressed in white, followed them. Men dressed in dark suits marched behind. It was considered the first public protest of racial violence in the United States. Alexis Newman describes the scene as the parade proceeds to Madison Square. The marchers carried banners and posters stating their reasons for the march. Both participants and onlookers remarked that this protest was unlike any other seen in the city and the nation. There were no chants, no songs, just silence. Some signs read, "Mother, do lynchers go to heaven?" and "Mr. President, why not make America safe for democracy?" Protesters hoped President Woodrow Wilson would make good on his election promises to promote rights for blacks. But Wilson took no action. In fact, he opposed anti-lynching legislation and continued segregationist policies in federal offices. In an editorial for the New York Age, James Weldon Johnson pointed out, quote, that their brothers and sisters, people just like them, were Jim Crowed and segregated and disenfranchised and oppressed and lynched and burned alive in this, the greatest republic in the world, the great leader in the fight for democracy and humanity.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for another sunny day with temperatures in the high 80s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect similar condition with temperatures creeping into the low 90s. On this date in 1868, the 14th Amendment guaranteeing citizenship to African Americans and all people born in the United States was officially adopted into the U.S. Constitution. The 14th Amendment was framed in 1864 by Ohio Representative John Bingham, who said, quote, "Black men helped to make the Constitution as well as to achieve the independence of our country by the terrible trial of battle," end quote.
To no one's great surprise, Reince Priebus today resigned as the president's chief of staff. The resignation came 1 week after that of former press secretary Sean Spicer. The notification of a staff change came via the customary tweet when Trump announced that, quote, I am pleased to inform you that I have just named General Secretary John F. Kelly as White House Chief of Staff, end quote. Only after that did he tweet a thanks to Priebus for his service. The Priebus resignation had been anticipated ever since White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci trashed him in an interview in yesterday's New Yorker. In the interview, Scaramucci called Priebus a, quote, effing paranoid schizophrenic, end quote, and accused the former Republican National Committee chairman of leaking information to the media. He also said Priebus would be, quote, asked to resign very shortly, end quote. The interview was seen as clear evidence that White House infighting has escalated to new levels and that the recently hired Scaramucci would be acting as Trump's hatchet man.
Today's report from Climate Connections looks at unique homes in the UK that can protect themselves from floods.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During a flood, a brick house rises into the air on metal stilts. Sound like sci-fi? Not quite. If an ambitious developer in the United Kingdom gets its way, this could be the future of homes in flood zones.
With a flood warning, the house will be elevated, so your property and your contents are safe.
That's Adrian Brotherton of the Larkfleet Group, the company that designed the house. The home can be elevated almost 5 feet with a built-in jack system. This means that during a flood, the house is kept high and dry while the residents evacuate. The idea was inspired by the UK's housing shortage. The company wanted to find a way to develop homes in flood-prone areas, where people cannot build now. And as climate change increases storms and sea levels, more flood-resilient homes are going to be needed. Not only would the houses be safer from flood damage, Brotherton says they look less obtrusive than the homes on stilts found along many American shorelines.
The house can remain at ground level. It can look like a normal, everyday house.
It will be years before the design is fully tested, but if all goes as planned, the future could include homes that can be literally lifted out of harm's way. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren says the Republican efforts to destroy Obamacare piecemeal through a skinny repeal isn't a compromise and will destroy the most critical parts of the Affordable Care Act. If Republicans are successful, she says, health insurance will be unaffordable for millions of people, especially those with pre-existing conditions.
This isn't a more moderate version of the Republicans' ugly plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act. This isn't compromise. In fact, this may be the worst idea they've had yet. Because if Senate Republicans vote to repeal the individual mandate, they're getting rid of the linchpin of the insurance markets in this country. And that's because this provision, the one that the Republicans want to junk, is what keeps the price of insurance affordable for people with pre-existing conditions.
Warren says the callous attitude from Republicans about what repealing the Affordable Care Act will really do to endanger the health and lives of millions of real people is reprehensible.
Senate Republicans who voted to move forward with their effort to rip away Americans' health care are not listening to the people they represent. Their vote was irresponsible. It was reckless. It was cruel. It was immoral.
UAW President Dennis Williams, in a letter to union members, says he is appalled by an alleged criminal misuse of funds by a Fiat Chrysler executive and a former UAW vice president. Williams says the UAW has zero tolerance for corruption or wrongdoing of any kind. The UAW says the alleged criminal conduct by the late General Holyfield, a former UAW vice president who died in 2015, was a betrayal of trust by a former member of our union. A former Fiat Chrysler executive was indicted for conspiracy and other federal crimes for allegedly embezzling funds from a workers' training center in a conspiracy with the former UAW official. No union dues were involved in the alleged crime. The UAW is conducting an internal investigation into the allegations in the indictment. Industrial global union affiliates worldwide, including in the U.S., are welcoming a stated commitment from Rio Tinto to improve that huge company's relationships with trade unions. Rio Tinto is the second largest group of mining companies on the planet. An Industrial statement on the new development said, quote, Industrial welcomes the commitment and we will invest in developing and monitoring this new relationship. Rio Tinto has made a policy decision to change the culture of the company. This is a groundbreaking development, and it's long overdue for this global giant to recognize the role and importance of trade unions, end quote. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
On Thursday, the U.S. Senate voted overwhelmingly to apply new economic sanctions against Russia. The 98-2 vote in the Senate followed Tuesday's House vote of 419-3. The measure specifically targets Russia for its involvement in the Ukraine and Syria, but does not reference Moscow's influence in the 2016 elections. The bill also applies sanctions to Iran and North Korea over their weapons programs. The Russian government responded by demanding a reduction in the U.S. diplomatic contingent in Russia and confiscating two properties used by the U.S. State Department. In a unique twist, the bill specifically prohibits the president from easing or removing the sanctions without congressional approval. The president is strongly opposed to the bill, but last week the White House signaled that the president would sign it if it passed. A presidential veto would raise further questions about possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. Republican Bob Corker, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said, quote, I cannot imagine Mr. Trump rejecting legislation with such a veto-proof majority in the Congress, end quote. Of course, if he did veto the bill, it wouldn't be the first time that Mr. Trump has done something that none of us could imagine.
Deborah Shipman is a PSU student and an organizer with the Yakima Tribe. She's with us today to talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women in the Pacific Northwest. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how's everyone there?
Oh, we're fine, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Deborah. The issue of missing and Indigenous women has a lot of visibility in Canada, but not much in the U.S. Yet the problem may be as bad or even worse here. Do we have any idea what the actual number of victims may be in the U.S.?
Well, that's what, I also run a nonprofit called Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. And we're in the midst of making the first database. There are no databases with Native American numbers in it. So we're in the process of making that right now. And we're seeing a lot of numbers. We've got over 1,000. And Canada is going to really pale in comparison to what we're finding. And right up above us in Washington State is some of the worst numbers.
Deborah, the number that you're quoting of over 1,000, what part of the U.S. would that actually cover?
Well, see, now this is like the first five states that we went into, and that would be Washington State, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, New Mexico, Arizona, and Oklahoma. And those are all specified as Indian country under the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that's where the biggest part of your reservations lie, and we're seeing this as like very chronic across the United States.
We've heard here that two women and one man were murdered in the Yakima Nation this summer. When something like that happens on tribal lands, who's responsible for investigating and how does that proceed?
Well, anything over a misdemeanor is taken automatically to federal government, and that would be the Bureau of Indian Affairs and their law enforcement is the FBI. And one of the ladies that was just recently announced that she passed away, Her name is Felina Metzger. And she was actually found last October, but the FBI has kept her family waiting all this time for a positive ID, and they just released it like it was 2 weeks ago. And then we had a woman found in Yakima Lake, and they were supposed to have let, you know, the tribe know about that, her autopsy, and those haven't been released. And then a man was found murdered, I believe it was last Friday. So, yeah, it's and I had Yakima elders in my home on Sunday, and they said that they didn't even know what the jurisdictions are. You know, it's like if something happens up there, they don't know who's in charge of it. So that's one of the things our organization is going to do, too, is just try to establish you know, a protocol when things like this happens so that these families are not abandoned.
Deborah, why do you think there's so little visibility to this problem in the U.S.?
To be totally honest, I think, you know, it's what happened to our people is still a great shame. And what's happening right now and here, present day, is a great shame, and it just continues. It continues the genocide, and actually, these things that are happening, where, you know, these criminals are not prosecuted, with these murders are not, you know, they don't try to find who did it or anything like that. That is a violation of the 1948 United Nations. Their description of genocide is fitting of that. Anytime you take an endangered people and make it hard for them to survive, then that is genocide. So that's what we're looking to prove with these numbers and getting this database. This just shouldn't be happening. And everybody in the Pacific Northwest should be taking this personally, what's happening to these people, because we don't even know it, and it's happened right under our noses. So that's why I say, you know, take it personal, because who would have ever thought that this was going on in this lovely land, you know, that we live in.
Deborah, our understanding is that PSU will be hosting a summit on Native American violence in October. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we're the cultural department at Portland State has over the past 18 months helped a lot in a lot of different ways, and gave us a platform to talk about. And as we saw, you know, just how bad this was here in the Pacific Northwest, and we're gathering Northwest tribes. And going to have a summit and sit down and talk about what's going on, compare what one's doing, you know, learn from each other, and figure out a plan to step forward. The main thing that we look to get out of this summit is a safer place for our little girls to grow up.
Understood. So we're starting to run out of time. So the final question I would ask is, what can our listeners do to help?
Well, they can go to our Facebook page, which is Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, and just join us. We're going to have a march across Yakima Nation. We're going to do some things with what's left of the summer. So if you could just follow our page, realize what we're doing, and come out and support us and hear some of these stories from these families. But yeah, and then we're going to be on next week too on KBOO next Wednesday, so we'll talk more about it.
Very good. We'll look forward to that. Deborah, thank you so much for your time, and good luck with this.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's broadcast is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. Coming up Monday morning on KABU, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 it's More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste discussing the ways public lands are under attack from the Trump administration and right-wing militants. At 9 the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the great issues of our time and goes where corporate media fears to tread. At 10, Locus Focus visits the Columbia Riverkeeper to discuss the resistance to Northwest Innovations Works' plan to build a methanol refinery in Kalama. At 11, it's the On the Ground Radio with a look at Our Revolution, founded by Bernie Sanders, as they launch the Summer of Progress campaign. Also, war crimes in Mosul, Trump trans ban in the military, and protests of the anti-BDS Senate bill. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.